Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan. On today's show, we check in on Beirut Design Week and investigate how the event has buoyed the city's design scene.
I find it odd when we're Arabs and we have just very French European furniture and no element of our culture. And in a way, I open the eyes of people and saying, you know what, we can be proud of what we have.
We also head to Copenhagen and throw some clay with ceramics company Tortoise. Meet Canadian typographer Rod McDonald to discuss his latest creation for Monotype and finish up with a summary survey of seaside must-haves from Monocle's sartorial sage, Jamie Waters. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Despite not being renowned as a region for its design scene, there are murmurs of progress throughout the Middle East. Beirut is currently hosting its fifth annual Design Week, the fastest growing festival of its type in the region. As well as spurring young product designers and studios, the fair aims to strengthen the creative industry and foster a culture of entrepreneurship in Lebanon and throughout the region. But is it working? Monocle contributors Edward Woodhouse and Venetia Rainey headed to the opening weekend to find out.
When the red flags start popping up all over the city, you know it's Beirut Design Week. Now in its fifth year, the event has tripled in size since it began. On top of workshops, talks and parties, the week also sees Lebanese designers across the capital host open studios to showcase their work. I've come to one such place in Saifi Village, a leafy part of town where the light pastel-coloured walls, cobbled streets and manicured gardens give an impression of order and calm. By contrast, the boutique I'm in, Bokja, is an orgy of clashing colours and fabrics. One retro wingback chair in particular stands out.
So it's a 1950s model. So here we have a piece that's a vintage piece that was upholstered with an assemblage of fabrics. That's a Bokja assemblage. Every fabric has a bit of a story in the sense that it was collected and there's a story within the collection process. This is a piece of a Versace shirt, actually. And once you juxtapose it with these type of Asian fabrics, it starts to create a dialogue for people that know what each one actually means culturally.
That's Bokja's creative director, Adrian Pepe. He says this chair is classic Bokja, a design studio founded in 2000 by two Lebanese designers, Huda Baroudi and Maria Hibri. Using local craftsmen, they rework old fabric and furniture collected in Lebanon and elsewhere in Asia. Pepe says this thrifty attitude is typical of Lebanon's post-war design scene.
It came together with a whole group of designers that didn't leave Lebanon during the wars, and they stayed. And this is why I think it's a very special aesthetic that was developed based on the fact that you had to be very resourceful with your materials. So then this resourcefulness started to inform a type of aesthetic that's very unique to the space. And you can essentially look at something and say, oh yeah, that's a very Lebanese aesthetic.
A few streets away is another cornerstone of the post-war Lebanese design scene, Nada Debs. Having grown up in Japan, she moved to Lebanon 16 years ago and has since become known for the way she skillfully combines minimalist Eastern ideas with Arabesque geometry. The centerpiece of her latest range, a table made from a cross-section of a tree trunk, is a perfect example of this.
This table, it's a solid acacia wood, and I superimpose the geometry on the edges, and the workmanship is tin inlay. And the fact that it goes around the curve of the solid wood, it's a difficult process.
For Debs, as for Bokja's founders, her primary concern as a Lebanese designer has been finding ways of promoting local craftsmanship, influences and heritage, and marrying that with a more modern aesthetic. When she first came to Lebanon, she noticed that no one was interested in investing in local manufacturers.
They thought people did not know how to do good quality. And I kept telling them that it would be really important to show how proud we are. And so that became my mission, to actually export rather than import, because most people wanted to just import the furniture. I find it odd when we're Arabs and we have just very French European furniture and no element of our culture. And in a way, I opened the eyes of people and saying, you know what, we can be proud of what we have.
Debs, Bokcha, and many others have helped create the foundations for Lebanon's distinctive design scene. And now Beirut Design Week is helping mix this older, more established, and more experienced group of designers with the new blood coming up. Pepe again.
I think that at this point, what you're seeing is a generational thing. It's like, what is the new generation coming up with? And does it relate to the previous aesthetic?
To find out, I headed to KED, Beirut Design Week's dedicated space situated in a disused factory by a busy main road. Its four stories are now filled with work by designers from Finland, Germany, Switzerland, the Netherlands, and of course, Lebanon. Part of the week's aim is to foster emerging talent through its Disrupt Design Program, essentially an incubator for design startups. One of the companies who benefited was Rain, a two-man outfit producing beautifully crafted paper origami lampshades decorated with Arabic calligraphy. Calligrapher Khal Hawila explains more.
It has the depth of bringing both Oriental and Arabic calligraphy mixed together and preserving this craft. So each piece is handwritten and hand-folded, so it's handmade. But when you look at the object, you don't see origami or calligraphy. You see modern, contemporary. So it's something, it's a design, not a calligraphy or origami anymore. It's something beyond that.
Rain's designs were typical of the Lebanese work on display, with an enormous emphasis on heritage, local craftsmanship, and sustainable materials. From intricate gold jewelry inspired by Armenian architecture to bags made from recycled hoardings, it's clear the Lebanese design scene continues to channel that potent combination of nostalgia and innovation that has made the city a trendsetter for the entire region. Now, with Beirut Design Week firmly cemented as a formidable platform for the established and for newcomers, its influence in the design world would seem set to go global. For Monocle in Beirut, I'm Ed Woodhouse.
That was Monocle contributors Edward Woodhouse and Venetia Rainey reporting from Beirut Design Week. Stumble into any decent mid-century furniture store, and chances are that many of the pots stood atop the teak dressers on the shop floor would have been made in Denmark. Along with the UK, Japan, Korea, and Germany, Denmark was one of the most important ceramics capitals of the 20th century, and the industry remains alive and kicking today. One of the leading lights in the contemporary Danish ceramic scene is Erik Landen, an American-born potter whose brand Tortoise Copenhagen is based in the centre of the city. Landen's pots fit well in the Danish vernacular. Think simple, hand-hewn vessels coated in lustrous but unlavish glazes. We sent our contributing editor Tom Morris to Tortoise's HQ to try his hand at the craft.
Sat in his cosy 18th century studio in the centre of Copenhagen, with Herman the Rabbit running around under the wheel and a kiln humming in the background, Master Potter Erik Landen is slapping a ball of white clay, ready to throw one of his fluted vessels. Erik first took to ceramics when he was at school in his home of Milwaukee. Like so many, he left the craft behind in the schoolroom for many years, but after moving to Denmark in the 1990s, took it up again on a whim at a local community centre. What began as a hobby soon became a career, and after studying ceramics at the prestigious Danish design school, he set up his brand Tortoise Copenhagen in 2012. Like any decent Danish design master, Tortoise Copenhagen's pieces are deceptively simple in form. And like Hans Wegner's or Arne Jacobsen's skills with wood, it has taken years of practice to build up this level of expertise. And yet, the American makes it look so easy.
Well, right now I'm starting to shape my ball of clay a little bit into a cone, and I'm placing it on the center of the wheel. Right now I'm patting the clay into a cone and making sure that the clay is extremely attached to the wheel.
Yeah.
And now comes the fun part. So I'm just applying a little bit of water, and I'm kind of leaning into the clay so that I really create suction between the clay and the wheel so that doesn't go flying off. And now by applying pressure between the palm of my two hands, just press together, and you can see that the clay starts to rise, and I slowly take my hands up the surface. And this is what's called coning.
So you're sort of pulling that up a good sort of 30 centimeters off the wheel at a time and then back down, aren't you?
Yeah, there's kind of a sport in how tall you can get your cone. And it's extremely impressive. If you're a beginner, I wouldn't suggest making your cone quite so tall. But the taller I make my cone, the more that I can get the clay to relax. So I'm going to do this about 4 or 5 times. Each time I do it, the clay will be just a little bit nicer to work with, a little softer and a little bit more relaxed.
Can you tell me about what clay you're using and what? I mean, it's very sort of light clay. It's stoneware clay?
This is stoneware. It's probably made in Germany. And it's a pretty ordinary stoneware that I use. I don't buy, you know, extravagant clays. I actually make extraordinary things out of rather unextraordinary clay. But it has really nice qualities. It's grogless, which means it has no sand and no particles in it. It's very fine to work with. But some people would find this clay a little bit frustrating because it's not very forgiving. So now I'm opening.
So you put your fingers right in the middle, and then out of the sort of lump, you've pulled them to the outside to create a sort of hole in the middle.
Yes. And this is when the ball of clay becomes a vessel, because it can actually hold something on the inside.
How long did it take you to master this? I mean, did you have months and months or years of it wobbling all over the place? Does that still happen?
Fortunately, I picked it up pretty fast, but I am still learning after 25 years. Sometimes there's good days in the studio, sometimes there's bad, and every now and then there's a bad day that reminds you that you're human, and then you have to go back and figure out exactly what's wrong with your technique.
Danish pottery is known for its minimalism and simplicity, just like so much of Danish design. It's why the vessel is so popular here, ever since the Danish modern period in the 1960s, as design doesn't get much more straightforward than a simple up and down form. Tortoise's Unica vessels are known for their incredible paired back shapes and quiet pastel glazes, but Eric likes to throw a curveball in there from time to time. Quite literally, many of his vessels have a shapely, curvy quality to them.
So you'll notice that there's an arch in the entire wall, and I throw my cylinders always in an arch because it's kind of like the Romans designed bridges with arches. It's a very stable form, and if I want to make very tall cylinders, it's best to make them with an arch in the wall so that they don't collapse.
Do you know exactly what you're going into and what you want to produce when you're sitting at the wheel?
I have to have a slight idea, because if I'm going to make something that, for example, is bulbous, then maybe I need to have a cylinder that has a very wide base. Whereas if I'm going to make a very tall base, then I need maybe a base that isn't so wide. So the base cylinder that I make, or the proportions of the ball of clay before I even open, they have a lot to say about what I'm going to end up with. And now I'm going to collar the neck, which is my way to make the neck quite narrow. So it's as if I'm strangling the clay and lifting at the same time, and you can see that the neck starts to close. And I've been doing this for a very long time, and it's still so satisfying each and every time I do that. And you can see that I actually spin the wheel quite fast, but my hand movements are very slow.
How fast is the wheel turning?
My guess would be 200 rotations per minute. So I'm gently applying pressure and gently lifting the neck up.
Once the vessel is finished on the wheel, it will dry for around 24 hours, and then Eric will trim the base. It'll then be fired once to around 1,000 degrees Celsius, cooled, then glazed, and then fired once again to 1,280 degrees C, and then we'll have the finished vase. Before that happens, though, Eric uses a tool to smooth the outside of the vessel.
You can see how nicely my tool glides over the surface. I'm very careful about the way that I prepare my clay. Everything from the wedging, which is the kneading of the clay, down to the coning of the clay and compressing and centering. If I do these things all extremely well, it means later on I have a lot of freedom and I have the ability to only, for example, shape from the outside with my tool. If I was to try to do this and I wasn't so careful early on, then my tool would hit a hard spot or a dense spot, or a spot where maybe the clay isn't quite so homogeneous, and then the tool would start to hop on the surface. And this is why they call me Tortoise, because I'm very slow and I'm very careful, and it always pays off in the end.
That was Eric Landon of Danish ceramics company Tortoise, speaking to Monocle's contributing editor, Tom Morris. Last week, the 129-year-old Foundry Monotype launched its newest typeface family, named Classic Grotesque, at an event in Toronto. Designed by Canadian typographer Rod MacDonald, the font comes in 56 styles and takes its inspiration from a handful of early 20th century sans serifs that would eventually go on to inspire the creation of the ubiquitous Helvetica. Monocle correspondent Chris Frey spoke with MacDonald about the challenges of contemporary type creation and what today's typographers can glean from digging through old archives. He started by asking MacDonald to tell us about the history of the old grotesque typefaces and the surprising utility and freshness they can offer designers today.
This is probably not the best medium to be describing, what is an intensely visual form. Grotesques are an actual genre of sans serifs, and they're an old genre. They actually go back to the 19th century. The ones that I'm working with, Classic Grotesque, is actually based on three old grotesque typefaces, European typefaces, from 1906 to 1926. And what I'm trying to do, those typefaces have had a tremendous influence over the last 7,500 years. On Helvetica, for instance, grew out of that, although it's not considered a grotesque. It's called a neo-grotesque, actually. And most of the successful sans serifs tend to be neo-grotesques. What I'm trying to do with Classic Grotesque, and I'm not the person that can actually answer this, but I was trying to make a typeface, a grotesque, that could work in a broader range of applications than the original grotesques did. To be honest, they were kind of funky. Grotesques were always kind of funky. And I'm trying to keep some of that funkiness, but bring it up so that, it can go a bit more mainstream. And I'm liking the look, and apparently quite a few other people are too. So I'm hopeful.
Could you give us sort of the instructor's definition of the difference between like a grotesque and, say, a Helvetica?
Helvetica tends to, and typefaces like Helvetica tend to be what we would call more regular. Really no surprises in the letter forms. Full, usually horizontal endings on letters like, say, the S and the lowercase a, where the returns, what we call the returns on those strokes, end horizontally instead of at an angle, as you find in most of the grotesques. I grew up being told that the letter forms of Helvetica were the ideal letter forms for everything, that they worked better than the grotesques, and there was lots of, people would point to studies and say, yes, this proves it. Well, I don't think so. When you look at the grotesques in a sort of fresh light and say, you know what, these work just as well. There's no reason they can't work just as well. And in fact, they actually do have some advantages. And one of them is they have a certain openness that Helvetica doesn't have.
Tell me about some of the challenges of designing a face that works equally well on the page and on screen.
Okay, I'm going to go back a little bit. I'm going to go back quite a bit, actually. And in the days of metal type, when a person or a foundry, a major foundry, produced a typeface, they produced it in a range of sizes. So you could buy it in 12-point, you could buy it in 8-point or 10-point or whatever. You couldn't get in between sizes. And they would actually change these sizes. They would change the design because the eye doesn't see things exactly the same way when something's large and something's small. So optically, in the old days, they would compensate for this. Well, we can't do that anymore. So now I have no idea, when I work on a typeface, how it's going to be used. I don't even know if it's going to be used on screen or in print. If it's going to be used in print, is it going to be a high-quality publication like Monocle? Or is it going to be, just a newspaper rag, rag paper? I don't even know what size. It could be a billboard. Or it could, I just had one of my typefaces used for a postage stamp. So the designer today, the designer of a typeface today faces a lot of obstacles. And it's almost, it's a Herculean task, I think, and we all do. And so, to some degree, it's almost impossible to achieve. And that's one of the reasons why a good typeface today takes so long to produce. We've got tools that are fantastic, but what we're called upon to produce takes repeated testing and testing and testing. And, you know, it doesn't matter. It looks good at one size. That's not enough. You've got to test it over and over.
Can you give me an example of one difference and how you would kind of bridge the gap between how we read on, like, say, a backlit screen versus, you know, something as flat as a page?
Mm-hmm. Typefaces on screen often require a little strength just to hold up because they've got to compete with this backlighting. So, again, the other thing actually that I did, and some of this has been a while now because it's been such a big project, I kept the layer spacing quite open, very not loosely spaced, but open in the way that these faces were 70, 80, 90 years ago. And it turned out to be the smartest move I made because it meant a typeface that right out of the box works on screen and really brings a unique look and a very pleasant look to pages. You know, the tight setting that really started with Helvetica is extremely difficult to work with now on screen and in print. And when I notice now when I'm looking at typefaces like Helvetica, it's tight and it's very cramped.
When designing a face, do you think of yourself more as an artisan or an engineer?
I start off as an artist. That slows down pretty quickly. When you're a type designer and a type maker, you're in it for the long haul, and you've got to be able to switch from that artisan, that sort of artistic juice that gets you going, into an engineer. And it's a bit of an internal struggle, I think, for most type designers because, you know, very often, I mean, it's an old adage amongst type designers. You know, you typically may start with a lowercase a, and you say, oh, I love that lowercase a. You just fall in love with it. And, of course, eventually the day comes, you know, 6 months to a year later, where you keep looking at proof after proof after proof and wondering what's wrong. And one morning you realize it's that lowercase a that you love so much. And, you know, and then there's that, you know, the screaming out the window and the sort of, you know, and go back to your desk and you say, okay, what do we have to do to make this work? And then you start.
That was typographer Rod McDonald speaking to Monocle correspondent Chris Frey. If you're in the Northern Hemisphere, summer's practically here already. And what better way to usher it in than with a rundown of some seasonal sartorial picks with Monocle's fashion researcher Jamie Waters. Here he is speaking to our design editor Josh Fennett.
Who's that coming out of the closet? Offering a fresh take on global fashion, it's Monocle's bespectacled sartorial trend spotter, Jamie Waters.
Jamie Waters, I can see all manner of things that look like they've been washed up on a beach. We've got swimming trunks, we've got sunglasses, we've even got what looks like a wetsuit here. Where are we going to start with this sea-themed selection?
Well, I think we should start with the wetsuit, which is...
We've got this in studio, so it looks like a kind of like varsity jacket style, like bomber affair. Is this meant to be worn casually? What's the situation here?
I mean, you can do what you like. You can just wear it around the street if you'd like, but there's a lot of colour, so it's sort of got a navy base. One sleeve is red and one sleeve is beige, and there's a red collar. And I really like it because it's something different that you don't really see.
But what's the big idea? I presumably can't wear this in water.
It's a wetsuit. It's from a surfing brand from Australia called the Critical Slide Society, and they're based on the Central Coast. And I think it's a couple of sort of artists and surfers who've created this label. And they do a lot of other things. They do sort of board shorts and stuff as well. But I'm a big fan of this wetsuit just because it's something quite different, and it's colourful, but it's not sort of too in your face. And I'm not a surfer personally, unfortunately, but I imagine that
the accent says otherwise, Jamie. The accent does say otherwise. It's a beautiful item, and I kind of feel like you could get away wearing that just walking around, right? Just keep it open.
Be a bit
warm, but you get away with it.
Why not? Yeah.
So a lovely wetsuit from some artistic Aussies. What have we got here? What can I see in front of me? These kind of yellow, what kind of yellow are you calling that?
Canary.
Oh, a canary yellow short. Tell me about these guys.
So this is a really exciting new brand from Uruguay. It's a men's swim short brand. It's called Marinae. And they're from Punta del Este, which is this region. I think there's a resort area there, but the couple who make this brand are from a village called Manantiales, which is slightly down from the resort. And they were telling me about this area, and it's very sort of rural and there's farms, but it's also near the sea. So it sounds like quite an amazing place. But their swim shorts are cool because they've sort of got some quite interesting details about them. So the pair we've got here are, as you said, bright yellow, but they're the first luxury swimwear brand to use bonded seams. So if you look at the bottom of the shorts, they're bonded, so they're completely flat. And what that means is that the shorts don't bunch up on your leg.
Oh, that's a perennial problem, isn't it?
Exactly. So they're sort of meant to be a tailored fit for slightly stockier guys, because one of the founders, Alessandro.
I've got a spare pair of these, actually. I think I can see myself heading home in them.
Yeah, it sounds like it's right up your alley, and I think it's all in the details. So they don't bunch up. They're slightly tailored. They sit a couple of inches above the knee, which I think is where you want swim shorts to be. I think they're doing something interesting.
And they've got a kind of beautiful green trim inside. Everything about them looks nicely made. And that's Marinae with an accent aigu on the E from Punta del Este in Uruguay. Jamie, what's your final item?
My final item is a sunglasses brand from Copenhagen. I've just discovered them and I'm very excited because it's just in time for summer. They're called Folk and Frame. And it was started in 2014 by a graphic designer from Copenhagen. And they're really cool because he said he's inspired by vintage things. So he says he sort of went through all these old films and posters, but then it's also kind of got that Danish simplicity, and so he's modernized them. So my favorite model is
we've got pictures of them here. We've got the Clausen, which is a kind of light tortoiseshell colored. The two little dots on the kind of, what's that called, the bridge?
Temple.
On the temple, that's right. And beautiful, very simple, very kind of blocky and thick and kind of graphic as well.
Yeah, and I like the little details. So we've also got one here called Eckersberg, and I like it because it's sort of got that kind of 50s Wayfarer type style, but then it's also got this metal band above the bridge, which I think adds a nice kind of detail without it being too sort of elaborate or over the top. So I think this is my sunglass brand of the moment.
So if we take stock of what we have here, we have a beautiful Australian wetsuit brand. What's the name of that?
The Critical Slide Society.
The Critical Slide Society. Then we head to Punta del Este for a beautiful swimwear brand called Marinae. And finally, Folk and Frame from Denmark. Thank you so much, Jamie Waters.
Thank you.
That was Monocle's fashion researcher, Jamie Waters, speaking to our design editor, Josh Fennett. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Holly Fisher, and studio manager, Chris Grimes. If you have any comments or queries, then please drop me an email. I'm at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, I'm back next week at the same time. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud, and iTunes. And if you're a fan, please leave us a comment. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.